In the dark times, will there be singing? Yes, there will be singing about the dark times. Bertolt Brecht.
Oh, wow. Hello and welcome to Neo Bohemia. I'm your host, Charlie Layton. It's been over a year since I've made a recording or an interview. The last one was in October 2016, and I apologize, I've been away. I've been thinking and listening a lot of processing. If you ask me why I haven't been interviewing, it's not that I ran out of people to talk to. It's just that I really froze, because of the effects of the election. I wanted to make a podcast that didn't have so specific of a timestamp, and I know that all art is political. It's kind of unavoidable to address the life and times in which you live, but I didn't want what I would talk about to be so strongly shaped by this current administration. I thought that maybe I could talk with artists about their problems and struggles that would be timeless, and talk more about process in a way that is more abstract and transcendent. But I know full well that the examples that come up a lot are here and now, specifically here and now. And I froze. I really froze. So with me today is Cynthia Silver, and we're talking about the subject of empathy. Cynthia is an acting teacher. Cynthia is a film and theater director. And Cynthia knows quite a lot about relating to a person, trying to recreate stories and realities based on a script, or trying to relate human emotions and human experiences to other people. We're both teachers at the Atlantic Theater Company as well, and we run into the subject of empathizing all the time. So this would be a good person to talk to about empathy. Hi, Cynthia.
Hi, Charlie. I'm so happy to be here. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. Thank you, Cynthia.
It's kind of an intervention, really. Yes. And we should tell them the story of how this came to be.
Right. So I haven't interviewed anyone in over a year, and Cynthia is spurring me out of my artistic paralysis just to talk to somebody, and I owe her a debt of gratitude for that. It's not going to be perfect, I know that already, but at least it's something. I'm getting out of my funk.
Yeah, and also being really honest about it, which, you know, is honesty and truth is currency in this climate. And I think that what you have been going through is very relatable. And I think a lot of people will get a lot of value out of hearing about, you know, that particular experience. And, you know, also because, Charlie, as a teacher, I know, you know, people have a certain perspective, you know, a certain impression of you. And I know I certainly do. And when I bumped into you in the faculty lounge that day and I said, "What's going on with the podcast?" You know, I was like, "What's going on? It's so good." And I was listening to it, and then it just stopped, and what's happening? And then you were really honest with me about what was going on with you. And I relate to it, but at the same time, I think it's a crucial time to keep the dialogue going about what we're going through.
Yeah, absolutely. I've spent a long time just trying to listen and trying to process, and I think that that has helped me.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like it's a good time to start up again, and I thank you for helping me through that.
I did kind of berate him. I was like, "Charlie, We are the soul doctors. Storytellers are soul doctors.
Oh.
We've got to tell stories. That's how we get people to, that's how we get people to empathize.
That's right.
Yeah. So it was kind of a little bit of a browbeating.
Yes.
So I applaud you for listening.
Thank
Being
you,
able
Cynthia.
To discern through the tactic of berating and listen to the content, that takes a lot of, you know, talent on your part. So
thank you. Cynthia, so how would you define empathy for you as an artist?
Okay, well, I would be lying if I didn't say that I was like boning up on the topic a little bit this morning, because I was like, oh my God, Charlie's coming over to talk about empathy. What the hell do I know?
Uh-huh.
Here's the thing. There's a difference between empathy and compassion.
Okay.
Okay. I too have been going through a certain, you know, process since the election.
Mm-hmm.
And I realized that if I were going to survive, that probably I needed to figure out a way to listen better.
Mm.
And so it started with this time last year, I took a class through Stanford University through their online courses. I took an online course taught by a woman named Kelly McGonigal. She is a clinical psychologist, and she has an amazing TED Talk that's worth listening to called How to Make Stress Your Friend.
Okay.
So it started with stress.
Okay.
I studied stress for 8 weeks with Kelly McGonigal online, and I learned about how stress is an opportunity. And after the stress class, her next offering, the next quarter, mm-hmm. which was spring of last year, was the science and practice of compassion.
Okay.
And because I'm such a fan of Kelly McGonigal, and my mom had taken the courses as well, I just thought, you know what, I'm gonna go down this path.
Share notes?
Oh yeah, we actually had some hilarious conversations about. The stress class, because apparently, you know, when you encounter stress, it's an opportunity for growth,
mm-hmm.
and for, you know, and it's an opportunity for to cultivate resilience. And so, you know, of course, it's like we had some hilarious conversations about how, you know, I was like on purpose subjecting my child to certain stresses because it was good for her. But that was, you know, but anyway, yes, we did compare a lot of notes, and particularly when it came to the compassion class. And what I discovered is...
the difference between empathy and compassion.
Oh, yeah. The difference between empathy and compassion. Well, let's see.
Now, does compassion relate more to sympathy?
Compassion is actually more of a belief.
Okay.
It's actually more of a belief that we are connected, and that the force that is connecting us is that of love.
Mm-hmm.
That's how Brené Brown defines it, is that compassion is actually the belief that we are all connected like that through a common humanity, and that the connective tissue is that of love,
mm-hmm.
or God or what have you. And that the empathy is a skill that allows for compassion to come to light. And empathy is kind of gets like sort of a bad name because we confuse it a lot of times with taking on someone else's pain.
Right, co-opting.
Co-opting it as opposed to being with it.
Okay.
Being with it in a way that allows for us to really see the other person and what their experience is, and to be able to not only see them, but to also have the ability to say, I'm with you. You know, I relate to this in some way.
Mm-hmm.
And it's empathy that actually, you know, gives us the ability to act with compassion.
Empathy gives us the ability to act with compassion.
Yeah, so it's actually a skill. Relating it back to acting,
mm-hmm.
I'll never forget. I remember I was up in Vermont with the Atlantic, and I was taking one of Katie Bull's classes.
Okay. Katie Bowl is a voice teacher.
Yes.
At the Atlantic
Theater. Fabulous voice teacher at the Atlantic, and I love her so much. And you know how Katie is, it's like she has an idea and she just, you can see her eyes light up and she kind of looks at you and she's like, oh my God. And she looked over at me, and at this time I was a repetition teacher at the school, which is now the earlier version of what is now called Moment Lab at the school.
Right.
So I taught repetition for 8 years. And so, you know, I'd been really, really interested in how does one put their attention fully onto the other person mm-hmm. without becoming like completely robotic and devoid of their own humanity.
What would be the value of putting your attention on someone else in a scene or in some sort of performance?
Well, it's exactly that. So that's the point, is that Katie, in the middle of her class, had this light bulb moment, and she looked at me and said, Cynthia, I realize what repetition is. And I was like, what? Tell me. She said, repetition is empathy.
Hmm.
It's the practice of empathy. And I'll never forget that moment. I mean, of course, she's like, it made me giggle because she was so excited about this discovery. But I was equally excited because I thought, she's right. That's exactly what it is. Our ability, it's not just our ability to put our attention, you know, outside of ourselves so that we're not self-conscious. It's our ability to notice, truly notice, another person's experience. And to give voice to it.
For the layperson listening, we should do a little explanation of what repetition is
sure.
and how that became Moment Lab. So sure. Based off of Stanislavski, going into Meisner,
mm-hmm.
Into David Mamet's work with Meisner, and then into David Mamet's own practical aesthetics.
Mm-hmm.
Repetition, as we now call it, Moment Lab, is a study of...
Well, it's the distillation of the moment-to-moment work, and it's most pure form.
Right.
We have to be able to practice being in the moment.
Yeah.
And there are ways to do that. And for actors, that way is through an exercise called repetition.
Right. And it's an exercise of interfacing with the partner in the scene and really trying to read, understand, and at some point empathize
mm-hmm.
with their emotional experience,
mm-hmm.
sometimes with no ulterior motive or no objective to accomplish, and then eventually getting to an objective that is similar to that of the character in a scene,
mm-hmm.
so that we create a scenario.
Mm-hmm.
And then eventually you replace the words that you're saying, meaning your observations, those words then turn into the lines of a scene.
Mm-hmm. Pretty much, yeah.
Great. So that requires a good deal of empathy.
Yeah. You really can't. I mean, look, it's like, you know, I say to the students all the time, you can use repetition for good or for evil.
Okay.
Right. You know, I have to speak in superlatives, but sometimes to like, you know, get them to perk up. But what I mean by that is that there's a way to repeat from your intellect
mm-hmm.
that doesn't involve your own instincts.
Right.
And your own ability to be affected by the other person.
And that's what you were describing of, you know, observing somebody but not actually experiencing the observation.
Yeah. Yeah. And so the other way to use it for good, that's using it for evil,
yeah.
is like engaging. And ultimately, it's engaging an ego.
Right.
You know, because usually if you're repeating from an intellectual place, you know, you're also concerned with how well you're doing.
Right.
And how accurate you're being and how much you're catching, you know, and it's very goal oriented in that way.
That might be good for poker players.
Sure. Strategy is great for chess, for poker. It's really boring when it comes to acting.
Yeah.
Because it requires you to be ahead of the moment.
Right.
You know, and anticipating what's coming next, as opposed to, you know, what people sign up for when they go to the theater, which is a moment-to-moment interaction.
Right.
That allows for the audience...
honest expression, spontaneous.
Yeah. That allows for the audience to get lost in it and feel as if they are participating in it, because they know, we all know when something is happening in real time,
mm-hmm.
versus when it, you know, it's like a person who hasn't studied acting may not know the technical terms, but they check out.
Yeah.
You know, they fall asleep. They go away. They start thinking. They go to the memory palace. So to use repetition for good means that you are putting, you are, first of all, engaging in a breath pattern that is different than the one that you probably engage in when, you know, in everyday life.
Mm-hmm.
And you are truly allowing yourself to experience the other person's energy and behavior. And it sounds a little woo-woo.
It's also private in a way.
It's
private and intimate.
It's intimate.
But you would probably do it in front of a class.
Yep.
And that's what theater, that's right. A similar dynamic of an exposure.
Yep.
Of personal feelings relating to somebody else, but you have to present it to an audience.
Really good repetition is incredibly vulnerable.
Mm-hmm.
Incredibly vulnerable. Because you are relying solely on your gut instinct.
Mm-hmm.
And your own purview, your own point of reference, all your experiences, your life experience, everything, your own truth.
Mm-hmm.
You're bringing that to the table to say, this is what I see in you.
Mm-hmm.
This is what I see is happening in you. It's subjective, right? But at the same time, it's subjective in that whether it's accurate or not, mm-hmm. you know, who knows? But you know, I'll never forget Scott Sigler saying, it's not about accuracy. It's about truth. It's mm-hmm. about, are you engaging in a truthful, you know, observation, mm-hmm. you know, and you're honoring your truth.
Right.
But to do that in a really dynamic and alive way, it requires a willingness to put yourself in the other person's shoes.
Mm-hmm.
If you put yourself in the other person's shoes, then you might notice something different than the experience that you're having.
Mm-hmm.
And that is empathy.
Definitely. There is something compelling about eye contact,
mm-hmm.
communal breathing in a shared space.
Mm-hmm.
And to some degree, the theatricality of standing apart from a group of observers.
Yeah.
So it intensifies the
it's disarming.
Yeah. It's very disarming, the times that I've had a repetition class or seen it.
And here's where the stress class came in.
Okay.
So part of what Kelly McGonigal talks about in her TED Talk is that when we are stressed, our heart starts racing. You know, we start like breaking out into a sweat. We might even shake a little, you know, our breath, you know, is like gets challenged. All of those things, it turns out, is our body preparing us for the challenge that is to come.
Okay.
And that if we can embrace that as opposed to try to almost like remedy it,
mm-hmm.
you know, it's like, look, how often do you walk into, right before you walk into an audition and you feel the nerves kicking in and you're like, don't be nervous, don't be nervous, don't be nervous. Then you become preoccupied with being nervous and trying to like combat that nervousness to the point that it's like you're not even in the room anymore.
Right.
The argument being that, and now the science is backing it up, that if we allow ourselves to look at stress from the point of view of this is my body.
Mm-hmm.
Preparing me for what's to come, you know, that I'm being taken care of. And it also turns out that when it comes to stress, when we're stressed, we have a hormone called oxytocin, right?
Right.
Oxytocin, you know, is known as the cuddle hormone. Our pituitary gland will pump this stuff out when we're feeling, mm-hmm. you know, warm and fuzzy. But it also turns out that it gets pumped out in moments of stress. It's like our pituitary gland is pumping this stuff out. And what oxytocin is priming us for is reaching out to others for connection.
Okay.
That's what...
Wow.
Yeah. So that was kind of the mind-blowing thing about the stress, lessons is just that it turns out that stress is priming us to socialize.
Okay.
It's priming us to reach out to others, to connect to another human being. But think about it. How often do we try to hide our stress?
Right. The denial of your personal experience of this energy buildup.
Yeah.
Is trying to disconnect.
Right.
Your physiological, neurological opportunity to really empathize and connect with.
Yeah. And I think it's what Brené Brown talks about. I think it's shame.
Shame.
Yeah.
Ashamed of being stressed.
Shame of being vulnerable.
Shame of being vulnerable.
Because sometimes reaching out, and seeking the connection of others, I mean, that in and of itself is vulnerable. It's a vulnerable act to ask for help, to ask for support.
That's great. I wanted to ask you if you had any suggestions. Would you have any advice for artists who aren't actors, who aren't physical performers, who work in different mediums, how this work of empathy can translate? Meaning, how does a painter empathize? Is it still the act of communion with the human?
Mm-hmm.
Is it still the inspiration that comes from sitting down and talking to people?
I think, I would say yeah.
There's definitely, I get a sense community. Of that as a musician.
Yeah,
When you jam with people.
Yeah. Sometimes sometimes it's just a matter of sitting in a room with other people. So here's the next thing that happened with my study of stress and compassion.
Okay.
I found out that Stanford University at this point has a Center for Compassion and Altruism Research Center.
Wow.
Okay. It was founded by a group of, neuroscientists and psychologists and philosophers, and at the head of it is, spearheading it is the former translator of the Dalai Lama.
Okay.
And so I found out about this place and I was like, what goes on there? And it turns out that they have done the research and have figured out scientifically, basically, what are the practices that cultivate compassion?
Okay.
And they narrowed it down to a science. And they have this teacher training program and they certify people to teach this particular course. So I found the woman who's certified to teach it in New York City and I took an 8-week compassion cultivation training course.
Wow.
At the Tibet House this summer. It was an 8-week class. It met every Wednesday night. This was a room full of people, New Yorkers.
Oh dear.
And let me tell you, a collection of kooky, crazy, wonderful New Yorkers.
Okay.
Of all walks of life, who've some, for one reason or another, decided that they wanted to cultivate their compassion. A lot of caregivers, some doctors,
mm-hmm.
a lot of teachers. And then, there was this one woman who had just finished her freshman year of undergraduate, and I thought to myself, oh my God, if I had taken this class after freshman year of being an undergraduate, I think that would have changed the course of my life
mm-hmm.
in a very profound and significant way. But here we all were and had no connection to each other than the fact that we were taking this class. Never seen any of these people before. Not so sure. I might run into a few of them here and there again, but we will never be gathered in that room again in that way, ever. And it made me think a lot about theater when I was there and church.
Theater, ritual.
Ritual, community.
Yeah.
A common ground of some kind, a common thread that we all had, that we wanted to, for whatever our personal reasons were, we wanted to cultivate more compassion. What I didn't realize is that what that entails is massive amounts of meditation.
Oh, dear.
Yeah. I was like, oh, this is a meditation class.
Right. Oh.
So that was really, you know, I mean, look, we all have read up on the benefits of meditation, but the actual practice of it is a whole other thing. And the practice of meditation is incredibly challenging because inevitably, within 1 minute of sitting with yourself, you come up against yourself.
Yeah, I can imagine New Yorkers with thick skins and short attention spans.
Yeah, this woman was amazing, Elizabeth. She really held her own, too. And I, one of the things that, first of all, in the 8-week course, like each class would be a different topic, whether it was compassion for a loved one or compassion for a difficult person.
Mm-hmm.
The class that required 2 weeks was compassion for oneself.
Yeah.
Because it turns out that you cannot have a true capacity for empathy or compassion without a concerted effort and practice of self-kindness.
Yeah.
And boundaries. It turns out, and this was really like, that was news to me. Setting boundaries is an act of self-compassion. Setting boundaries and honoring them. And in fact, if you don't have boundaries, then you're, you know, it's like all of your generosity and compassion and empathy is really actually not the real deal.
Yeah.
It's more a show.
It's interesting to think that setting one's own personal boundaries can actually be liberating.
Yeah.
That you have freedom to say, this is where I stop.
Yeah.
This is the extent of my ability.
This is what I'm okay with, and this is what I'm not okay with. And I think that we're, at this moment in time, are having a very important discussion about that.
Definitely.
I think it's worthwhile to say that it's January 17th. Yes. You know, because it's like, as you were saying, you know, you wanted this to be a timeless podcast. But yes. The truth of the matter is, at this moment in time, it's important to mark
right. Where
we are. So it's January 17th, 2018.
Yes, almost 3 days from the inauguration last year.
So right.
We're in our first year of this administration.
Yeah. So we're coming into the year anniversary of that. And needless to say, my compassion has been challenged.
Definitely. I think I was overwhelmed, basically.
Yeah.
I was very overwhelmed for all of 2017.
Yeah.
And I didn't know if I could go on with... I mean, I still made art. I still played music. I still did shows. But this podcast stopped because I had to reassess how it is relevant, how it speaks to working artists.
Right. And remember what I said to you, because someone very wise said this to me, is that it is not our job to determine whether it's relevant or whether it's of importance or whether it's, you know, worth anyone else's while to tell the stories that we are compelled to tell in this particular moment in time or in any moment in time, frankly. It is our job to honor what resonates within us for whatever reason that it does.
Mm-hmm.
It's like acting on an impulse, right? I always say to the students, it's not your job to determine what the impulse is or why you're having it. It's your job to act on it. And trust that it is adding to the conversation that is much needed in this moment in time. And if we withhold from our artistic instincts and our creative instincts and our impulses, then we are giving over to, one could argue that we are giving over to fascism.
Mm-hmm.
It's not comfortable. It's not comfortable. And we do really, in this, particularly in this moment in time, really run the risk of being judged. But, you know, as they say in the world of recovery, you know, and of AA, what other people think of me is none of my business.
Yeah. Yeah.
Hi, everybody. Thanks for listening. Normally, this is where I pledge for donations, and my GoFundMe link is still provided in the information of this podcast. But now I would like to pledge for your social currency, meaning if you could please share this episode with some friends, or if you want to write a review on iTunes, that would be great. If you want to contact me directly with questions, suggestions, you can visit the Neo Bohemia Facebook page and write a message there. Thanks again, and now back to our program.
So we're both educators, and we work with young people. There are many challenges that are new in regards to compassion, empathy. We could talk about identity. We could talk about technology and trying to relate. So I'm interested in seeing how, as older artists and teachers, how we try to relate to our students in their context of technology, identity, things like that. Because you teach a class about interfacing with humans and relating to them physically. And you and I didn't grow up with tablets, iPhones, the internet as robust as it is now. And I think that that's difficult, trying to teach kids how to look at another person, sustain eye contact, have an experience, and then observe that experience. And it's different in a way that wasn't as challenging 5 years ago, 10 years ago.
Yeah, the challenges were different. I'm up for it, though. I really am, because I really do feel that there is a way. I mean, look, the technology isn't going away. The internet isn't going away. Our devices aren't going away. You know, more and more every day, we become more dependent on it. I mean, I see it as a real opportunity to... And look, it was really... I mean, that was really also a huge driving force in, you know, getting me to go to compassion class every week, you know, for 8 weeks, was in the interest of being able to connect with my students as much as to connect, you know, to like deepen my connection with my child and my husband and my family and my friends. But it was a form of self-care, because I had to figure out a way to have compassion for people in my life that, for whatever reason, you know, relate to the values of the current occupant in the White House. So there were a lot of reasons why I was going to that class, but one of them absolutely was the students, because I could feel the generational gap happening, and it made me, at one point, I was like, oh, holy shit, am I irrelevant? I could be.
Yeah.
And
I worry about that.
Yeah. I think it's about embracing technology in a way that supports communion.
So there is a way to navigate technology and not lose your empathy.
Yeah.
I worry about Facebook.
I worry too.
About Instagram. I worry about how I'm losing a sense of relation because I'm having these superficial interactions.
Well, and not only superficial interactions, not only that, but I mean, there's a couple of dangers of it I do see.
Yeah.
One of them being these kind of like half-baked ideas that get put out there as a knee-jerk reaction. You know, I think it's like we have to, you know, and all of us, I know I absolutely have engaged in just like throwing out my knee-jerk reaction and then like, you know, really regretting it.
It's great for writers to write a garbage first draft.
Sure. Yeah, but then you've got your first draft out there already.
Yeah, and nobody re-edits.
No one, well, and also, I mean, no one wants to read your shitty first draft.
Yeah.
You know, this shitty first draft is important, but it's not the end.
It's
a first draft.
Yeah.
And I also think that it does do this thing where it's like, we just like, if we're putting all of our initial instincts out there, we end up not giving over to process in any way, and really like letting them, like mature and marinate.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they just like, you just kind of like spew them out there and then it's on to the next thing. You know, it's like ideas.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
spitballing.
Exactly. So I do think it can kind of like can turn into kind of like this dumping ground, this like wasteland of just like half baked ideas,
yeah.
Which is, you know,
which is counterintuitive to the idea of in repetition, you want to express spontaneously your experience,
yeah,
as you try to empathize.
Yeah, but see, there's safety involved. You're in the comfort of your own room and behind your computer screen. You have a knee-jerk reaction. You put it out on the interwebs.
It's not vulnerable.
Look, here's the good thing. The conversations that I am seeing right now with regard to racism in our country, with regard to the Me Too movement,
mm-hmm.
just so many. There are some
trans rights.
I have to say, I have learned a great deal. It has opened me up to perspectives I never would have considered. That is for sure. What I have figured out is that the trick of it all is to notice when you are feeling triggered or defensive
mm-hmm.
in some way, notice it and refrain from the immediate like outburst through your fingertips.
If you are a president with a Twitter account,
right.
Refrain from the immediate outburst.
God, I mean, you
could
know,
that,
this is all an opportunity, Charlie.
Mm-hmm.
We get to see, I mean, here's like the upshot. We get to see that dude's psychology on display.
Yeah.
So he puts all that garbage out there and we notice that there is there's a, you know, 30%, 36% of the population, you know, is like applauding it. So it's our job to get to the bottom of that and to tell some really good, compelling stories that maybe someone from that 36% might recognize themselves for, even if it's a moment. Mm-hmm. It's a moment of self-awareness, a moment of consciousness. And, you know, that's all we can hope for, really. That's when I know we've done our job and we are doing our job. You know, Charlie, what you did for the last year is you listened. And that's...
Tried to.
That's empathy. That's compassion. That is an act of compassion, because listening is also engaging curiosity. And curiosity is the very thing that allows for us to learn. You know, it's the gateway to learning. And in order for us to stay relevant as educators and colleagues, ultimately colleagues to this younger generation, is that we have to listen. I was saying to, I just shot a short film that a former student wrote, Charlotte Martin. She could have chosen a person of color to direct that film. It's an experience about whitewashing Hollywood, or Hollywood whitewashing, you know, and Charlotte is biracial. You know, she very well could have chosen someone of color to direct that project. And instead, she entrusted me with her script. And so I took it upon myself to make sure that I was doing everything that was within my control to bring that story to light in the way in which she intended it when she wrote it. And it was a great, great honor to do that. And I felt very, very lucky, considering the climate that we're in.
Mm-hmm.
But I also, it just became even more pronounced to me how much of a responsibility I have as a white woman and as an educator to educate myself. And that in and of itself is an act of compassion that sadly is lacking in our current administration.
I think I can honestly say that I don't know a working artist in New York City who would say that he or she, they have benefited from the last year of this presidency, from the effects of it. Maybe a comedian in a superficial way of like, I've got tons of material.
Sure.
Maybe Melania's interior decorator. I don't know. The point about that is that I froze up because I was trying to relate to the suffering and try to process all the feeling of being threatened and attacked almost on a daily basis from different sides.
Yeah.
Women, people of color, immigrants, LGBTQIA+, Muslims.
Yeah.
The list goes on. And so...
People with disabilities. I mean, it's just... Yeah, you're right. The list is... It's endless.
And to a person who doesn't... Who is not an artist, who is in favor of this administration, mm-hmm. who doesn't... Who can't relate to what I'm explaining,
mm-hmm.
it's stunting. I'm stunted. I've been stunted trying to relate to my colleagues, to my friends, to my students,
yeah.
and see the pain and suffering that's going on right now when so many parts of who you identify with and who you see yourself as are becoming lesser, are becoming threatened, are becoming attacked. And so I was relating to that and I was overwhelmed. Mm-hmm. I got stymied.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm back trying.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Cynthia, for spurring me. I'm reminded of this quote. It's an old quote from Franz Kafka. You can hold back from the suffering of the world. You have permission to do so, and it is in accordance with your nature. But perhaps this very holding back is the one suffering that you could have avoided.
Yeah, I think, you know, I had a really meaningful conversation with Charlotte Martin last week, whose film I just directed. And I said to her, you know, I could opt out very easily. That is my privilege as a white woman,
mm-hmm.
to opt out of the conversation because it is so difficult. And there are so many landmines that you can step on in any moment.
Mm-hmm.
But I know at this point in my life, as a mother, as a teacher, as a human, as a woman, I would much rather be clumsy, you know, just give myself permission, you know, to be imperfect,
mm-hmm.
striving, of course, to be mindful, striving to be more inclusive, striving,
mm-hmm.
you know, for, you know, more empathy, compassion. But I think I would much rather be in this discomfort than in the quote comfort of isolation. Yeah.
Apathy.
Yeah. Isolation, apathy.
Delusion.
Which is delusional, you know. And sidestepping discomfort has gotten us into this mess.
Yeah.
Avoidance, denial. Those are symptoms of shame.
Hmm.
And so we have to talk about it so we can overcome it and so that we can move through it and really change the conversation, change the dialogue, and hopefully, you know, make the world a better place for the, you know, for the generation to come.
Yeah.
I'm not going to say that it's like a bed of roses and happiness and blah, blah. In fact, it's made me less, like, I was listening to an interview with Brené Brown this morning, and she said, you know, the thing is about self-compassion and self-kindness, it's like, it's made me less sweet,
mm-hmm.
but it's made me more loving. And I'm okay with that.
You're able to be more loving if you're self-loving.
Yeah.
And you forgive yourself.
Yeah.
I find that is a personal challenge because I make mistakes. I've made many mistakes.
Yeah.
And trying to relate trying to practice the ideal of allyship as a white, cisgendered, older, straight person.
Yeah, you know, it's like we have a lot, and
but that's part of it.
Part of it.
Yeah,
it's just part of it. It is what it is, Charlie, and you know, and we're here, and yeah. It's a real opportunity.
Yeah,
it's an opportunity.
Right, and the opportunity to continue to persevere, it's almost a responsibility. Because if I just buckled and gave up, well, that's it. I can't relate anymore. I'm not going to try.
That's right.
That would be shame, too. Because that would mean that the shame that I feel is insurmountable and I can't go on.
Right. Right.
Or the denial of the suffering that I'm relating to as I get closer and closer to this person.
Yeah.
This artist, this student. Mm-hmm. I don't want to pull away from that. And I want to say something and relate to people in a way that's relevant. And I want to be a working artist. And yeah. I want to support other working artists. But I can't do it in isolation.
It's virtually impossible. You can't do it in isolation.
Right.
And we get to do it through stories. You know, which is really, how great is that? Yes. Like, we get to dress up and make believe, or like help people, you know, or like guide people to like good dress up and make believe, you know, yeah. And in an effort to bring people into consciousness. That's a huge, it's a noble profession.
Yeah. So I think one of the dangers of being an educator right now, especially with the younger generation, is that there's this danger of conflating empathizing, sympathizing, showing compassion with protecting them from the suffering of life.
Oh, yes. That's very true.
Like that we were supposed to shield them from their existence.
Yeah, no, that's not working out so well.
Yeah, I come up against that, and there is labor. There's emotional labor.
Yeah.
There's pain. There's difficulty with everything that we do, and that's not to be avoided. It's to be mined. It's to be
Let me tell delved. You something as a parent. I would love nothing more. Every time I see my child engaged in something that is painful to her, I would love nothing more than to reach in and grab that pain and make it go away. Mm-hmm. Because I love her. The greatest act of love that I can give her in that moment is to let her go through the pain so that she understands that she is capable, that she is resilient, and that she will learn from it, and she will come out the other end, and she will be okay.
Yeah.
It is a daily act of refrain. And Pema Chodron, who is this amazing, she's like the first female American Buddhist monk, and she's written some incredible books. I'll never forget, in this her book called When Things Fall Apart, she says that there is great courage in refrain. Because when we refrain from the thing that would fix it in the moment, that would make it all go away, that would make it dissipate, that would allow us to bypass difficulty, when we refrain from that and we lean into that discomfort, right? That's the greatest act of courage, because we are giving over to the realm of the unknown. And certainly that translates in the practice of storytelling and acting.
Yeah. Truthful behavior.
Truthful behavior. True behavior. Not the knee-jerk reaction. Not the quick fix. Not the numbing. Right? But, and look, it's like, That is daily mindful practice every day at every turn, you know, and really be mindful of the choices that we are making. Do I succeed at that? No, because I'm a human and I'm flawed. Which is why, Charlie, my latest subject of choice and study is forgiveness.
Forgiveness.
Yeah. I'm reading a book right now by Desmond Tutu called The Book of Forgiving. Mm-hmm. And that, it ties, I mean, it's a hard read, particularly right now. Mm-hmm. In everything that we're seeing. And so it's a book that he and his daughter wrote about their experiences, but also how forgiveness is a process, and there's four steps to it. The first step of forgiveness is taking ownership of your story and saying your story out loud. In our culture right now, people are telling their stories. It happened without anyone saying, like, hey guys, let's go through this forgiveness thing. Let's go through this truth and reconciliation thing. Organically, we are at a moment in history where people are telling their stories and taking ownership of them. Whether we move into the next step, I'm not sure. We'll find out. But we have embarked on what could potentially be a process of truth, forgiveness, reconciliation. And that's what keeps me, at this moment in time, that's what makes me hopeful. Mm-hmm. It's painful. And it's even, you know, I mean, he talks about just how incredibly painful it is to take ownership of your story. Brene talks about it too, like we're friends. Mm-hmm. You know, but she talks about it a great deal too in her books, particularly Rising Strong. Great book, really worthwhile, talking about taking ownership of your story. I'm reading in tandem with the Book of Forgiving, Braving the Wilderness, which is her newest book. And it really speaks to the time that we're in right now.
Yeah.
Really worthwhile.
So let's talk about directing.
Okay.
So you direct film and theater.
I do. I get to play all the parts.
Yes, in a way, a director plays all the parts and has to relate to all of them.
Yeah, empathy. And that's exciting too, like figuring out, like discerning the different psychologies of a character, you know, of each character, you know, that's engaging in an empathic process, figuring out how another person views any given situation.
Yeah. And you can see your actors' opinions of their characters in their performance. Figuring out
how
they best represent the story.
I mean, the trick is, I feel like, you know, the trick is as an acting teacher is to get them away from their, like, judgment of the character in any way, you know?
There's an ongoing fundamental lesson from The Atlantic is that you have to be on the side of your character.
You got to be on the character side, which is empathy.
Yeah.
That's empathy.
You have to empathize. Even if it's an antagonist, even if the person's values expressed in the play do not match your own.
Right. You have to understand what it is that they are striving for.
Yeah.
And that which is universal about that striving, that's what we can relate to.
Yeah. Truth.
Truth. Yeah.
Well, thank you, Cynthia, for coming on the podcast. This has been a long time coming, and I'm so glad to be back. I appreciate your motivating me.
Well, I'm happy to be here. I am here for you, Charlie. I do mean that.
Thank you. This was Cynthia Silver, and I'm Charlie Layton, and this was Neo Bohemia. Thanks for listening.